there are two ways that a person could be Jewish. A person may be Jewish because he was born to a Jewish mother. A person may be Jewish because he converts. In the last 40 years, the determinations of the former, what is considered to be a Jewish mother, has become more complicated with the advent and proliferation of various assisted reproductive technologies, IVF, realities of egg donors, gestational carriers, surrogates. That raises the question of who does halacha recognize as the mother, the genetic mother or the surrogate mother? And what happens when one of these partners is Jewish and the other one is not? What I'd like to discuss this morning is the halachic debate about the definition of maternity, and then we'll move on to some very contemporary recent issues that relate to this question as well that have come up in the last decade or so. Yesterday's parsha, Parshas Vayigash, when the Torah tells us about the 70 descendants of Yaakov Avinu that come down to Mitzrayim, source number one, Ubnei Shimon, Yimuel, V'yamin, V'ohad, V'yachin, V'tzochar, V'sha'ul, Ben HaKananis. One of Shimon's sons is referred to by the Torah as Shaul ben HaKananis. Who is ben HaKananis? What's that reference? Says Rashi, source number two. Ben Dina. Kananis is a reference to Dina. Shenivala Kanani. That Dina was violated by a Kanani. Kishahargu Eshchem. Lo haisa Dina rosa latseisa shenishbala Shimon shisa ena. So Dina was taken by Chamor, and when she was freed, she insisted that Shimon, her brother, marry her. So Shaul ben HaKananis is really Shaul ben Shimon Vidina. Asks the Moshe of Zakein in one of the collections of Bali Tosis on the Torah, source number three, the Tema, Heyach Nasa Shimon es Achoso. How was it possible that Shimon married his sister? V'alo Achoso mina eim asur l'bnei Noach. A maternal sister is a prohibited relationship even for Noachites. Even if we assume that the Avos, the descendants of Yaakov before Matan Torah, still had the status of Noachites, they weren't bound by the Torah, which is a different discussion. Nevertheless, even for Noachites, it would be prohibited to marry a maternal sister. Says the Moshe of Zakein of Yesh Lomar, De'ein lehem arayus ela b'ulas baal, ve'nira. Eli Yishlomar, so what answer does he like? She'ikar heirayon shel Dina b'beten Rachel Haya. That Dina was actually implanted, conceived in Rachel. And then there was some kind of embryo transfer to Leah. And that's what's reflected in source number four, the Targum Yonasan. Bereishis Lamed Kaf Aleph, V'achar Yalda Bas. The Targum Yonasan says over here that tells a story that at that point Leah already had six sons. If she would have had a seventh son, so then Rachel, knowing that there would only be 12 Shvatim, would only have a maximum of one son, and that wouldn't be right that Rachel would have fewer sons than the Shifchos. Therefore, Leah davened that she should end up not bearing another son, and there was this transfer between Rachel and Leah, that the baby that Leah was carrying was transferred to Rachel, the baby that Rachel was carrying was transferred to Leah, and Leah ended up giving birth to Dina, who was actually the genetic material of Rachel. So some say, you see from here, this is evidence that the genetic mother is the halachic mother. Is what do we see in the Moshe Zakenim? That the genetic material of Dina was in fact Rachel's, and even though Dina was carried by Leah, she was allowed to marry Shimon because apparently her halachic mother was Rachel, and then she was not considered to be the maternal sister of Shimon. So that's what some want to say, that maybe this is a source for determination of maternity as being based on the genetic mother, to which others respond that you can learn out from Agatha. This is a somewhat tenuous suggestion here. It's not a halakhic context, so how much can you learn out from this Moshe Zakenim and Targum Yonasan?
Or from Maisa Nisim.
Good point.
What if a woman
If a woman converts, so then you mean if she converts when she's pregnant?
No, before she marries.
If she converts before she marries someone, then the baby will be Jewish. Good. Okay.
No, so, before she, you're saying that she's.
Right. Right. So that we'll touch on conversion in this context in a few minutes. In the other direction. Rabbi Binyamin Karlbach, one of the Rosh Yeshiva in the Mir, in his Sefer Chavetzelis HaSharon, points to a comment of the Maral in his Parish on Megillas Esther, or Chadash, source number 5. Vayhi omein es hadasa, ki ein lo ava'em. The Maral writes, ki ein lo ava'em uksiv b'mos avia v'ima lamali. So the Pasuk already says that Esther didn't have a mother-father. Then it says, when her mother and father died, Mordechai took her in. So what's that double lashon of Ein la'ava'em? And then, b'mos avia v'ima. Amar Rav Chista, ibarta ima mesavia. At the moment of conception, her father died. Yiladasa ima mesa'ima. And at childbirth, Esther's mother died. V'nir shadar shikach mishnei Misheni, ki b'mos avia v'ima, hu yisar. So that additional language of b'mos avia v'ima is extra. V'lav yitzarach lift up, you don't have to write it. L'kach darash, that's why Chazal derived b'mos avia, haynu b'sha shenasa la'av. So what does it mean when her father died? At the point that he became a father, namely the point of conception. U'b'sha shenasa yisla'ima, v'zeh b'sha shenolda. And when her mother became a mother, namely when she gave birth, then Esther was orphaned from her mother. The Bishasa Ibar, at the time of conception, came in Shiloh Pirish of Lami Manolonik Radainima. Since the baby is still in utero, hasn't yet been born, that's not considered a mother. So this comment sounds like maternity is established at birth. The birth mother is the halachic mother. Okay. Let's move on. There are two Gemaras that also seem to indicate contrary positions on this matter. Take a look at source number 6. The Gemara in Yevamos Tzadi Zayin Amud Beis is discussing a woman who converts while pregnant with twins. So at the time of conception, the woman was not Jewish. At the time of birth, the woman is Jewish and she gives birth to twins. So the Gemara indicates over here, Shnei Achim Ta'omim Gerim. You have two twins that are Gerim. The context is that the mother converted when the babies were in utero. Lo Cholzin V'lo Miyavit. So if there were to be a Chalitza situation or Yibim situation where one of the brothers dies without children, and then there would, under normal circumstances, be an obligation of Yibim between the surviving brother and the widow. So here, that's not the case, because we do not recognize the father as the halachic father, because at the time of conception, the mother wasn't Jewish, hence there's no halachic relationship between the father and the children, therefore no din of Yibam. However, what emerges from this Gemara is that the children are considered to be the children of the mother. So they're not the children of the father, but they are the children of the mother. Sounds like maternity is determined at birth. Look at source number 7. The Gemara in Yevamos Ayin Ches, that's the major sugya of Muberesh and Iskaira, a pregnant woman who converts. The Gemara says, "V'na'in tzarach tefila." If a woman converts when pregnant, once the baby is born, there's no requirement of tefila. The baby is considered Jewish. Why is there no requirement of tefila? So the Gemara indicates, as Rashi explains, that the mother already was tevelas, so the mother's tefila counts for the kid. Once the mother herself goes through gear and does tefila when she's pregnant, the tefila covers the child as well. I'm sorry?
It sounds like
Ben Pakua, okay. So what does that mean? If not for the fact that the mother underwent the tefillah, then the child will not be considered Jewish. Even though at the time that the child is born, the mother's already Jewish. At the time of conception, the mother was not Jewish. At the time of birth, the mother is Jewish. So it sounds like if not for the fact that the mother underwent the tefillah that covers the kid would not be Jewish. So that sounds like maternity is determined at the time of conception, that the halachic mother would be the genetic mother.
But yeah. Children who are given to women, Jewish women who mm-hmm. adopt a child who
right.
is not born of a non-Jewish mother,
right.
they're usually considered Jewish.
Well, no, you'd have to convert the child. Then the child is not Jewish unless you convert them. So under those circumstances, you do a gerus for the child.
They're converted at infancy.
That's called gir katan. That's a form of geiris, right? So they do need a geiris. Very good. Rabbi Bleich, in an early article written in the 70s, which was reprinted in his first volume of Contemporary Halachic Problems, this article was written even before the first successful IVF transfer. So he quotes an essay written by a Rabbi Yekutiel Aryeh Kamelhar in 1932 in a sefer called HaTalmud U'Mada'ei HaTevel, I guess roughly translated as the Talmud in Natural Sciences, source number 8 over here, where he makes reference, he was a Galitziana Rav, Rosh Hashiva in some town in Galicia, who wrote a lot. So he references here, I'm not going to read it inside, a medical convention in Chicago in 1921 in which they discussed the possibility of a uterine transfer and what that would mean medically. So in the context of this discussion, Rabbi Kamelhar discusses what would the halachic status be of a child born with the genetic material of one mother but carried by another mother. So he has an interesting raya. He refers to a Gemara in Sota Mem Gimel Amud Beis, source number 9. There the Gemara is talking about Orla, that if you plant a fruit tree for the first 3 years, the fruit is prohibited to benefit. One may not benefit from the fruit. That's called Orla. The Gemara says, Yalda Shesivcha Bisekena, source number 9. If you have a new plant, a seedling, that you graft together onto an older plant. So the older plant, the older tree, is already past the Orla moratorium, but the seedling would be subject to the restrictions of Orla. So if you have a young seedling that you graft onto an older plant, butla yalda bisakena. So the seedling is nullified in the face of the older plant. Ve'ein badin orla, and therefore there is no halacha of orla. So Rabbi Kamelhar makes a jump, that just like you see over there in the context of orla, that if you have a young seedling that you graft onto an older tree, there's no orla. So here too, if you take a rechem, you take a uterus from one mother, and then you implant it in another mother, so the genetic material or the rechem of the first mother is going to be batel to the second mother, and the birth mother is the halachic mother, Rabbi Weiss.
It's not quite the same thing.
Because
in the case of the Moshe Tzkenim, in the case right. of Aral,
yeah.
we're talking about a conceived
right.
child already.
Right.
Here we're talking about either it's the uterus or the
right.
ovary, I wasn't sure
right.
what it was, but there hasn't been conception taking place. You can
right.
say that even if the mm-hmm. beitza came from
right.
the other woman, it's already batel,
right.
and now the conception is taking place.
Right.
Inside the woman. So
right.
I don't see the...
Yeah, you could definitely...
No, his raya might be a good raya, but
right.
it only applies if the conception is taking place in the woman,
right.
not where you're doing a baby transplant.
Right. Okay, I hear that. So you said... Good, I hear. The good point. Even in his own context, it's questionable whether you can learn out one from the other. That you're correct. That's a good point. Rav Asher Weiss in the Tshuva rhetorically... responds to this raya and says, "V'chi ha'adam eitz ha'sadeh," that what raya could you bring from Orla to the question at hand? The bottom line, there is no real consensus among contemporary poskim as far as determinations of maternity in these kinds of cases. On the one hand, you have poskim like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zichrono Levracha, and Lehadim and Chaim Lechayim, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, Rav Shlomo Zalman son-in-law, who are inclined or were inclined to the position that the surrogate mother, the gestational mother, is the halachic mother. That's the inclination of our Avezdin of Gedalia Dov Schwartz, he should have Refuah Shleima.
Says what?
Says that the surrogate mother, the gestational mother, is the halachic mother. In Rabbi Kamelhar's piece over here, he says that he discussed this matter with Rav Meir Arik. Rav Meir Arik is one of the leading Galitzianer poskim in the generation before the war, and he agreed with his assessment. So Rav Schwartz was inclined to this this position that the gestational surrogate mother is the halachic mother. On the other hand, Rav Avadia, Rav Eliashiv was reported to have taken this position, B'Sof Yamav as well. Rav Asher Weiss is inclined to this position. Rabbi Willig is inclined to the position that the genetic mother is the halachic mother. Rav Asher writes that he thinks that's more likely that the genetic mother is the halachic mother, because just as everyone agrees that paternity is determined by the genetic father, then it should follow that maternity would be determined by the genetic mother. But as a practical matter, because bottom line, this is a matter of dispute that is generally unresolved, even if poskim may be inclined in one direction or the other, so the practice of Batei Din across the board, both here and in Eretz Yisrael, is to require a geiris any time one of the potential mothers is not Jewish. So if you have a non-Jewish egg donor, you have a non-Jewish surrogate, in both situations, the practice of Batei Din would be to require a geiris. Whether you view that as a geiris l'chumra, whether you view it as a geiris mikra or din, absolutely necessary, would depend on how you fall on the theoretical question. But as a matter of practice, the recommendation of Batei Din around the board is that whenever there is a non-Jewish candidate here for mother, a geiris would be required. It was actually reported in last week's... I'm sorry?
Without a bracha.
Without a bracha, right. Without a bracha. Safek bracha sahakal. Good. There was an article last week's Yediot Acharonot, clearly the context of attacking the Rabbanut, because that's what the secular media does. But apparently they were reporting that the Batei Din and Eretz Yisrael are beginning to take a more proactive role in trying to identify children who are conceived through artificial reproductive techniques in such a way that they would proactively reach out to people and tell them that they would require a geiris and not register the children as Jewish unless that status is resolved. As we over here in our Beis Din, not infrequently will be contacted by people undergoing some kind of fertility treatment where there's a need for a surrogate or an egg donor with the request that we certify the Jewishness of a potential egg donor or a potential surrogate to avoid the problem. Obviously, a person, if they are in the situation, would not want to have to deal with a non-Jewish mother in the equation. So someone may have questionable Jewish status or need to prove their Jewish status. They may reach out to us to make those determinations so that someone could safely undergo this process knowing that the players are all Jewish. In recent years, in the context of Gir Kat, in the context of Geiris done for minors, for children, anecdotally, the number of adoptions in the Frum community are down significantly, and the number of children conceived through these kinds of artificial reproductive techniques are up significantly, so that a larger number of Gir Kat that we're doing are these situations of non-Jewish egg donors or non-Jewish surrogates. Yeah.
If the egg donor and the gestational mother are Jewish,
mm-hmm.
How do you handle the question of kurva for marriage?
So then we'd be machmir in both directions to treat each mother as a potential.
How
do you track it? So some of, in a situation in which there is the need for anonymity, the recommendation is that the person be informed of the birthday of the anonymous mother. That way, when it comes to shidduchim down the road, they'd be able to compare that birthday with the birthday of the mother of any potential partner.
Still could be big chumra, because you would be including a lot more people.
More people are born on the same day. Okay, but if it's a 1 in 365 chance, that's the birthday anyway. Okay. But a related issue that comes up in this context, and you know, if you are recommending do a gir under these circumstances, the person presumably has to be in a situation where gerus is warranted. That even for gir katan we have standards. The general, what we'll call consensus position, is that since conversion of a minor, this isn't our topic, but just take a 1 or 2 minute digress for 1 or 2 minutes, the basis of gir katan, of converting a minor, the sugin ksubas dafir aleph, is zachin la'adam shalabafanav, that since a minor isn't of his own or her own mind to decide what he wants to do with his life, you need das bezdin, you need the bezdin to provide the das, the knowledge, the consciousness of making this decision on behalf of the child, and you have to determine that it's indeed a schus, that it is meritorious for the child to become Jewish. So the general consensus, what we'll call the consensus position among poskim, is that in order to determine that it's a schus, the child has to be raised in a from environment where there's a likelihood that the child is going to grow up to be observant, because if they're not going to be observant, then they're better off not being Jewish. We'll call that the consensus position. So then, if you have a family that doesn't meet that threshold, it's questionable whether you could do gir on the child even under these circumstances. There's some debate whether the bar may be a little bit different in this situation, depending on what you view the ikar adin, halachic mother, as being. So that's a little bit of an ongoing discussion. Do you move the bar a little bit in these kinds of situations for what standards of gir katan are necessary? Sometimes we may tell someone, look, according to half the poskim, your child's Jewish anyway, and when the child becomes of age, they'll see where they're holding religiously, and if it's in their interest to do a gir l'chumra, whatever you want to call it, they'll do it at that point. Rav Schwartz, our Rav Bezdin, dealt with the following situation once. There is a IVF, a child was conceived through an IVF cycle done with the zera of the husband who was a Kohen, and the non-Jewish egg that was implanted in the Kohen's wife. So you have a Kohen married to Mrs. Kohen, and the baby is carried by Mrs. Kohen, but the genetic material, the egg, is from a non-Jewish woman. So we would require a gerus because of that, at least a suffix, whether the halakhic mother is the genetic mother or the gestational mother. But how does this affect the kahuna status of the child? They have a boy. The boy, no one in the world knows that the boy was conceived with a donor egg. And everyone would assume that the boy is going to be a Kohen. Yeah. So either he's a Kohen or he's a Ger. So in this situation, Rav Schwartz paskind that you have to view the child as a Kohen l'chumra, but not l'kula, meaning that he should not go to cemetery, he should not be metamei l'mesim, but at the same time, he shouldn't duchen. But as far as the most public manifestation of being a Kohen, getting an aliyah, so because Rav Schwartz himself is inclined that in principle the gestational mother is the real halakhic mother, so he's willing to be makel about giving the child the Kohen aliyah, since anyway there's no isser in giving a non-Kohen the first aliyah, it's just covet of the Kohen to give the Kohen the first aliyah. But in principle, there's no isser violated if you were to give a Yisrael the Kohen aliyah. And others who are more inclined to view the genetic mother as the halachic mother probably would not be prepared to give that child the Kohen aliyah either. Okay. One even newer issue, you know, the question of IVF in these situations goes back about 42 years. An even newer issue in the last decade plus is that of mitochondrial DNA replacement. So, I'm not a biologist nor a physician, but my lay understanding is that every cell has mitochondria, and every mitochondria has mitochondrial DNA, which is purely maternal. So a person's mitochondrial DNA is only passed down by the mother. And there are certain diseases that are linked to certain anomalies in mitochondrial DNA, which has spurned a new technology of replacing mitochondrial DNA. I think it's called mitochondrial replacement therapy, where when you're undergoing an IVF cycle and you know that there are certain genetic diseases that the egg donor or the mother has, so there is a relatively new method of replacing some of those sections of the mother's mitochondrial DNA with someone else's mitochondrial DNA. So that raises many ethical questions, and I believe that in certain countries, maybe even the U.S., there's a moratorium on this now. It's been in the news over the last few years. I don't know exactly where things are holding as far as the actual process or if it's being implemented, but in theory, this raises the halakha question of here you may have three potential mothers. You could have the surrogate and the egg donor and the mitochondrial DNA donor whose mitochondrial DNA is inserted into the egg that is being implanted through an IVF process. So if we focus on the genetic mother over here, if we have two genetic mothers, which is the halachic mother? Rav Asher Weiss writes in a tshuva that he doesn't believe it's possible to have two mothers. You could have a suffix as to who the right mother is in a previous discussion, but he thinks that there should be bittul, that if the majority of the genetic material comes from one mother, then the mitochondrial material from another mother would be bittul to the first. Rabbi Bleich, yeah?
Assume there were two mothers. The child is carried in one, and either the child, she got an egg,
right,
that was not hers,
right,
or it's her egg.
Well, here the further complication is that in the IVF process, you're transplanting mitochondrial material from another mother and mixing that into the egg of the one mother that you are that you're conceiving in vitro.
Oh, you're putting
right. So Rav Asher thinks that there's bittul. Rabbi Bleich, in an article in Tradition a few years ago, points to an interesting raya to suggest a different position. Take a look at source number 10. The Gemara in Sota, Membeis Amembeis, discusses Goyas. Goyas is referred to as Ish HaBeinayim. And the Gemara's four interpretations, what is the meaning of Ish HaBeinayim? The fourth interpretation of Yochanan, Bar Mea, Papi V'chad Anani. Now he was a son of 100 fathers, Papi, Papa, and one dog. What does that mean? Says Rashi, source 11. Ben Ataroves, he was a son of a mixture. Shabo Harbe Anashim Al Ima B'layla Achas. His mother was violated by many men in one night. V'nis Abra Min Echad, but she became pregnant with one of them. Nimsa Echad Aviv V'kula Minafim. So only one of them was the real father. We don't know who it was. One of them was the father, and the rest of them were not. Toso, source number 12, and that Gemara, has the following line, and the fourth line, Achila Nisrucha Hazera Ha'isha Misaberis Mishnei B'nei Adam Ka'achas. Tosa suggests that when the Zera is still fresh, a woman in theory could become pregnant from two husbands at the same time. So there could be a combination of the Zera of two different men that impregnate a woman at the same time. And then the child would indeed have two fathers. Says Rabbi Bleich, if it's possible to have two fathers, and the genetic material of two fathers, maybe it's possible to have two mothers as well. Okay, so that is a, let's call it an unresolved question that will have to be further analyzed as this technology progresses.
I don't see the raya. By conception...
Right.
Okay, first of all, it's not clear if everybody agrees with that.
That's correct. That's
Machlokas
Rashi Tosas. That's correct.
No, before that.
What?
There's Machlokas in the Gemara whether a woman is misaberes from two people or not.
Right, right.
So there's a Machlokas in the Gemara whether it can happen.
Right.
Then we're saying that even if it can happen, it can only
right.
happen under very, very specific
right.
circumstances.
Right.
It's not clear that those circumstances would include IVF.
all Rabbi Black is saying is that you have a model for the possibility in halacha that you could have two genetic fathers, and if that possibility exists, so theoretically, maybe have a possibility for two genetic mothers as well. He wasn't saying that as a raya muchrach of the paskin based on, but raising the question that maybe that is relevant in this discussion. Okay. Let's move on to an even more recent development in the world of genetics. There is a Dr. Carl Skorecki, who I believe is originally from Canada, who is a professor, might be retired at this point, in the Technion in Haifa. He was responsible for a lot of research into the Cohen gene 20-something years ago. But in a more recent study, he discovered in research in the last couple of decades that 40% of Ashkenazic Jews have a distinct mitochondrial DNA haplotype. A haplotype is a kind of a DNA sequence. That 40% of Ashkenazi Jews are descended from what he identified as four different haplotypes going back 1,000 years in Europe, such that if, given that mitochondrial DNA is purely maternal, if someone would have one of these markers, that should be a strong indication of their Jewishness. In one study, they discovered that a certain haplotype, a certain sequence of mitochondrial DNA, appeared in 54 out of 1,500 Jews, and 7 out of 51,000 non-Jews. So the question is, can the discovery of one of these haplotypes in a person be used to prove his Jewishness? So on the one hand, this looks like a pretty impressive statistic that 54 out of 1,500 Jews have this haplotype, 7 out of 51,000 non-Jews don't. But at the same time, if you look at the entire global population, given that Jews make up 0.2% of the global population, then in terms of numbers, more non-Jews have this haplotype than Jews. So just in the last few years, there's been a bit of halakhic literature on this. Rav Asher Weiss gave a presentation on this topic to a conference of Israeli Batei Din in Tammuz Tavshin Ayin Zayin, which was reprinted in a sefer called Orach Mishpat. There was an essay written on this topic in the most recent volume of Bemarei HaBazak, which is a collection of tshuvos of Eretz Chemda, Kolel for Dayanim in Eretz Yisrael. And Rabbi Zev Litka, who's an up-and-coming star in the Bezdin world, or Dayanus world in Eretz Yisrael, came out with a sefer, Beirur Yadut, Leor Mechkarim Genetiyim, Determinations of Jewishness in Light of Genetic Studies, which includes tshuvas written by Chief Rabbi Rabbi David Lau, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, and others on these topics. The shaila that Rav Asher was addressing, which is what we would call a low-stakes shaila, was he was asked by one of the Dayanim in Australia about a Jewish boy, secular Jewish boy, who was married to a non-Jewish girl, and the Jewish boy couldn't really care less about the fact that he was intermarried, but it really bothered his family. Nothing they could do about it, but they discovered when this girl took a certain DNA test, that she tested positive for this haplotype of mitochondrial DNA that indicates a strong likelihood of Ashkenazi descent. So there, the question is just making the family happy that maybe their daughter-in-law is really Jewish. But the more relevant question is, there are plenty of times where someone is unable to conclusively prove their Jewishness. You have people coming here or Eretz Yisrael from the former Soviet Union with claims of Jewishness but dubious evidence. So can genetic evidence ever be used, or these kinds of genetic studies be used to prove Jewishness? So before we analyze that, we should devote a few minutes just to discussing what are the standards of evidence needed for proving Jewishness in general. A person comes and says, I'm Jewish. Do we believe them? What kind of evidence do we need if we don't believe them? Take a look at source number 13. The Gemara Masechet Daf Gimel Amud Beis tells the story of a certain non-Jew who would come to Yerushalayim every year to participate in the Korban Pesach, and they would give him a share in the Korban Pesach. He once went to Rabbi Huda ben Beseira in Bavel, and he was proud of himself that he was able to fool the Jews every year into giving him the Korban Pesach. So Rabbi Huda ben Beseira set a trap for him to entrap himself when he went back, and they ended up catching him. So Tosfos discusses here, one second, it sounds like he went to Yerushalayim every year, they gave him the Korban Pesach without asking questions. It sounds like if a person presents himself and says, I'm Jewish, you don't have to investigate further. Says Tosfos, source number 13, Mikan ein raya shenam in l'chol abal l'faneinu v'omer yisrael ani. Don't prove from this story of the Korban Pesach that if someone comes and says, I'm Jewish, we believe him. Because here, there's a situation of rov. The majority of people in Yerushalayim are Jewish, or the majority of people coming to bring the Korban Pesach are Jewish, then you have the right to assume that this person is from the majority. Vazlinan basarupa. So he says he can't prove for the Gemara Masechet that you believe someone to say that they're Jewish, because there you have a rov. The majority of people in Yerushalayim are Jewish, but the majority of people in New York are not Jewish. So that's a different standard. However, Tosa says, Yesh lahavi rai biperkacholei, it's different Gemara in Yivamos, the Amar lei zil gali onasiv basminach, that there the Gemara is a story of someone who was born to a non-Jewish father and a Jewish mother, who was having trouble finding a shidduch. So he was advised, go move to a different town. No one will ask you any questions. Don't ask, don't tell. You'll find a good shidduch. So it sounds like people wouldn't ask. And then he quotes another Gemara there in Yevamos, that a person says, Niskayarti beinu lebein atzmi, a person says that he's a ger. He's believed, migo, he could have said, Yisrael ani. That if a person, we don't know whether he's Jewish or not Jewish, he says that he was Megayer. So we believe to say he was Megayer because he could have said I'm Jewish, and we believe him to say that he's Jewish. Okay, so Tosa says the Gemara Masechet is not necessarily a raya, but there are other rayas that we believe someone to say that they're Jewish without asking any more questions. Source number 14, Tosa in Yevamos, thinks that there is a raya from the Gemara Masechet, but the bottom line is the same. And source number 15, the Ritva in Yevamos, Memzayin, Amun Aleph, the Ritva there says a different reason that we believe someone to say that they're Jewish. The last line, Milsa David la gluye velo mishaker, that if something is going, the truth is going to come out, we assume that a person is not going to lie. So someone comes and says that he's Jewish, and we'll get to the bottom of it one way or another anyway. A person is not going to risk his reputation by lying if he's going to end up getting caught having lied. So as far as that reason is concerned, in certain contexts, it may not be as relevant. Fine. But in principle, you see from these sources that if a person comes, we don't know one way or another if he's Jewish or not. He comes, presents himself, and says that he's Jewish. We believe him. Nevertheless, source number 16, the Bar Hetiv in the bottom of Evin Ezer, Simon Beis, Seif Dalit. The Bar Hetiv quotes, this seems to be the wrong marmakam, my apologies. The Brahitav quotes a Takanas Medinas Lita, a Takana from Lithuania going back 200 years, that if a person comes from a foreign country, we don't know who they are, person says that he's Jewish, you have to investigate. You can't believe someone. If someone is local, you know, the family, so then you assume that they're Jewish if they conducted themselves as Jewish. Someone comes from a foreign country, you don't know anything about them, you have to do some investigation. So that is the basis of what we'll call common practice, definitely in Eretz Yisrael with the Rabbanut, and here as well, that if someone comes and we know nothing about them, you have to do a little investigation to determine their Jewishness before agreeing to marry them off or do anything that would confirm their Jewish status. Yeah.
Since it's only Takana, and Meikaritin, apparently it's sufficient for a person to say I'm Jewish.
Right.
How thorough does the investigation have to be?
So there may be a difference between what's absolutely required halachically and what's required because of public policy. That's a much more complicated discussion than we have time to have right now. But just one more muck. Yeah.
It's very interesting that in Parsha Tolbis, in the Tolbis, we have 106 psukim, and also in yesterday's Parsha, we have the same number of psukim. So in Parsha Tolbis, Vayetar, we just discussed some valid in the Gemara, in Yevam, Shavit, Sadovis, Lubav. We have the only example of genetics in the Gemara, some Himu, Lato Imu.
Interesting.
Speaking, if the tumen is to the individual as the Rabbi Shalom is to the as the universe, then essentially the Tzach is the universe. Then essentially accurate measuring, then essentially speaking, then the brain is to the individual as the Rabbi Shalom is to the universe. So it's a study of a brain chemistry, which is so very, very, very important. We have to be very focused because it affects your fantasy and all of these things affect the brain chemistry, and this affects the nature of the zygotic formation.
Right.
So the brain chemistry tells literally everything today, the study of the brain and how these things affect. It's not what you can do, it's what you don't
do. Right. Okay, thank you. So just one more markup on this topic, the Chazon Ish, source number 17, Yerodea Kufnin Ches Oschess, quotes from Chaim Velazhin, the Chudah Meshulash. Chaim Velazhin wrote in the context of the Takanas Lita that you don't believe someone to be Jewish without evidence, is that if a person doesn't speak Yiddish, then clearly they can't be Jewish because every Jew speaks Yiddish. The Chazon Ish points out that was probably true in Velazhin in the time of Chaim Velazhin, but even in Bnei Brak in the 1950s, that was no longer the case. So that's a question of what the societal norms are for how to conduct yourself as Jewish. But by the time the Chazon Ish was around, he assumed that not speaking Yiddish was not necessarily a red flag to compromise someone's Jewishness. With this introduction, let's go back to our question as to whether existence of these mitochondrial DNA haplotypes could be used in any way as a proof of Jewishness. So in Rav Asher's tshuva, one of the topics or subtopics that he addresses is the question of simanim, the question of signs as identifying features. So this is relevant, for example, in the context of DNA evidence. Most contemporary poskim assume that DNA evidence is admissible to determine death in order to allow for a wife to remarry. This is very relevant in the World Trade Center issues. And this is based on the principle of Simon Mufak, that there are certain signs that are so clear that they could be used as proof positive to identify something for halachic purposes. So the Gemara in Bav Mitzia Daf Kaf Zayin discusses this in the context of a lost get. A person loses a get, someone else finds it. So how do you identify that this get was the correct get that belongs to a certain person? So the Gemara there says that there's a machlokas about a simen beinoni, an average simen, whether that is admissible min ha-Torah. But everyone seems to agree that a simen mufak, a super simen, is admissible min ha-Torah as evidence. So take a look at source number 18, Tosas Yivamas, Kuftes Vav Amud Beis, Dibra Maskel Vika Amri. So Tosas there says that we rely on a simen mufak, on this kind of a super simen, for Edis Isha to determine the death of a husband. What is considered to be a simen mufak? So there's a Rebbeinu Yeruchim, one of the Rishonim, that has a formulation that it's a davar barur she'eino nimsokach beguf acher. That is clear that this is something that doesn't exist in any other person in the world. So that's a very high threshold. But most poskim assume that that's a little bit lav dafka. The Beis Shmuel, source number 20, Evan Ezer, Simon Yud Zayin, Sifkata, and Ayin Beis, says that if you have, quoting for the Masses Binyamin, the Simon Mufak is, Shelo Yimsa Rak Echon Me'al. If you find it in one in 1,000 people, that's considered to be a siman lufa. So in the discussion of DNA evidence, so there the consensus of contemporary poskim, Rav Avadya, Rav Osner, L'chaim, is that given that DNA, the real DNA, is unique to an individual, so that everyone should agree it's considered a siman mufak, even if it's invisible, that still halakhically would be a siman mufak. But here it's hard to argue that existence of this haplotype is considered a siman mufak. Number one, it's something that in number-wise exists in more non-Jews than in Jews, even though Rabbi Litka here argues that, well, maybe those non-Jews are descended from Jews who apostated at some point, but that obviously would be hard to prove. And then, more fundamentally, Rav Asher points out that there's a big difference between arguing that this is a siman and the classic siman. Classic siman, let's say in the context of a Shabbos Aveda, a person loses an object, someone else finds it, and there's an identifying siman, an identifying marker on this object. So if you're looking at the big picture, Reuven lost an object, so he lost something. Shimon finds an object. So there are two different players over here. Reuven lost something, Shimon finds something. Reuven's object that he lost has a certain siman. Shimon's object that he found has a certain siman. So the fact that there are two different players here corroborates the likelihood that this is indeed the lost object, because the siman that Reuven identifies as being on his lost object is the same as the siman that Shimon finds on his found object. The same thing, Rahmanul Islam, you have a husband that dies, you can't easily identify him, so you know that there is a lost husband, or a husband who gets lost, we don't know if he's dead, and we know that there's a dead body, and there's a corroborating siman that matches between the lost husband and the dead body. But when it comes to this mitochondrial DNA haplotype, so here there's only one question. We're assessing whether this person is Jewish, and we're trying to prove that on the basis of the existence of this mitochondrial DNA haplotype. So that's not the same as your classic siman. Rav Asher also suggests that the real definition of siman mufak is, would you be surprised if you found someone else with the same siman? So if a person has, one of the classic cases in source number 19, Shulchan Aruch, a person has a certain a sign on a tooth in a certain position, so that would be rare to find on someone else in that same position. And the other question to address here is, does this fit into some kind of umdana, some kind of presumption based on circumstantial evidence? So the Gemara in Bava Kama Tzadi Gimel has the case of Gamal Ocher Ben HaGamalim. You have a violent camel who is hanging out with other camels, the Nimsahari Bitsido, and then you see a dead camel. So there's an umdana, there's a presumption based on the circumstantial evidence that presents itself there, that the violent camel is a camel that killed the dead camel, even though you didn't see the camel kill the other camel. Or in the case of Gittin Samachay, person's being taken out to be killed, and he screams, write a get to my wife. So normally, in order to authorize a get, the person has to say, write a get, and deliver the get. Here he just said, write it, and he didn't say, deliver it. So the Gemara there indicates that there's an umdana, there's a presumption based on the context that he wanted the get to be delivered also, just because of the situation, he wasn't able to articulate that fully. So that's another example of an umdana, presumption based on circumstantial evidence that we know what the person wanted. But as Rav Asher explains in his tshuva, when it comes to an umdana can either be used to determine what happened, so did the camel kill the other camel? It could be used to determine what a person's intent is, did this person want to get to be properly executed? But you can't invoke umdana to determine the reliability of scientific evidence. Rabbi David Lau, in his tshuva in this collection here, Biruri Yadut, thinks that maybe there are grounds to view this as an umdana of some sort, but even if it was, maybe an umdana isn't enough to determine Jewish status. Maybe there are other ways to explain the existence of this haplotype. So this is very much still a work in process. Rabbi Litka, the author of the Sefer, this is one of his main projects. He's pushing that the Batei Din Rabbaniim should admit mitochondrial DNA evidence in the context of Biur Yahdut. This is one of his projects now. The jury is still out as to how this is going to fall, but where this could be relevant is in a situation where, let's say, you're 80-90% convinced that someone's Jewish. You just don't have the absolute evidence that would make you fully comfortable. So maybe this kind of mitochondrial DNA evidence could be used to push it over the top. You have someone from Russia who comes, and maybe it says that they're Jewish on their Russian passport from 30 years ago, but that's not necessarily sufficient halachic evidence. There are questionable Jewish practices in the family. Maybe this could push over the top, but this is still very much a work in progress that there will probably be more discussion about in the coming years.
Connected to the controversy that I was reading about, that the Rabbanim was talking about doing DNA testing for some cases.
No, so what happened over there was really, I would say, very unfair to the Rabbanut, because they were going the opposite direction. They were attempting to use this technology or some related technology to prove Yadut. I mean, in situations where the default was that they didn't have sufficient evidence, they were entertaining using DNA evidence to push them over the top. And that was really very unfairly attacked in the liberal media as trying to disprove people's Jewishness on the basis of DNA evidence. Yeah, Mr. Basker.
In many cases of adoption, you don't know whether what you're talking about came from the mother or the father.
Meaning we don't know the identity of the father?
We don't know the identity.
Right. So that's another question. If you don't know the identity of the father, are there questions on mamzeris? That depends on if you're living in a population with more non-Jews from Brian. I'm sorry?
I was once an ombudsman and got a call in December from a woman in California stating that she lived someplace else, gave birth in New York, and then moved out as soon as she gave birth. Obviously, her child was adopted by somebody, and she didn't know. She just didn't want that child calling her up because, of course, it was holiday season.
Yeah, so you have to figure out if there's a question of Jewishness.
The question of this child was, you don't know either the mother or the father.
Right.
And DNA you find could be from either of them.
Right. Yep, so everything has to be addressed on its own merits. Okay, thank you very much.
Are you from Chicago?
Nope, never.
How were you referencing those Darius Schwartz?
Because you have Bezdin and the Bezdin of America.
I'm originally from Chicago.
Okay.
And my father, before the Nehemiah, was...